When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Major news. White Wine Question Time is going live, and not just any old where, only in London's West End. I cannot believe it. We have some incredible guests lined up for you. So, Saturday the 18th of September at the Leicester Square Theatre with Craig Revel Horwood. Yeah, just as you can smell the sequence of Strictly and the whiff of Spray Tan as it comes back to our screens, Craig will be in conversation with us. Come and see us. Then on the 9th of October, I can't believe they've all agreed to do this, but we're reuniting the cast of Grange Hill. So I've got Todd Carty, Tucker, Lee MacDonald, Zamo, and Alison Valentine, who played Faye, with a few other guests to be announced closer to the time. And then, finally, on the 13th of November, it's the ultimate girls' night out. We're reuniting the cast of Dunbreedin. So Tracy Ann Oberman, Julie Graham, Tamsin Outhwaite, Denise Welsh, and Alison Newman will be joining us live on stage. Tickets are on sale now. They're available from the Live Nation website or wherever you get your tickets. Come and see us. Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a truly magnificent actress who first stole our hearts over 20 years ago as Little Mo in EastEnders and has kept it captive ever since 2014 as Kathy Keating in detective drama Grantchester opposite Robson Green. She's been treading the boards, however, since the tender age of 10, where she started out in Annie. And by the time she'd hit her teens, had already appeared alongside stalwarts like Sheila Hancock, Peter Sellers and Michael Crawford. After graduating from the Central School of Speech and Drama, she was cast at the Royal Court opposite Ray Winstone and went on to work with Mike Lee before auditioning alongside hundreds of others at an actor's workshop for EastEnders, who were looking to cast the Slaters, a new female-led family on the square. Her heartbreaking portrayal of domestic abuse as the survivor Little Mo deservedly won her countless awards and saw her career skyrocket, with her going on to dazzle in the West End, most recently in Sweeney Todd, and on screen in Call the Midwife, moving on, The Mallorca Files, Torchwood, and for the last 7 years in Grantchester. Married to Darren, a plumber, who she first dated when they were at school in their teens, they've got two children, Blossom and Elwood. And she's spoken openly about how the family has dealt with Elwood's Asperger's and dyspraxia diagnosis. In order to support him and his needs, she took a considered break from acting and for 7 years only took one job a year in order to care and support him. Now she's back in production on the seventh season of Grantchester, and I cannot wait to catch up with her. So let's dial up Casey Ainsworth. How are ya?
Hi, I'm very good. Do you know what? That is the most accurate intro I have ever heard and listened to. Really, it's just brilliant because it is exactly all of the things. It encapsulates everything. Normally, you know, there's so much that's left out, but you've done the lot.
Thanks, babe. But what a life well lived. And, you know, I didn't realise But you had started out alongside, I mean, some seriously superb actors before you'd probably even hit puberty.
Yes, I did. It was all by mistake, really. I went for an open audition, which was a bit of fun. And I'd obviously done stuff at school and I'd really enjoyed it and all of that. My mum said, oh, let's go to that before we see your dad. I literally queued up, went in, you had to sing Happy Birthday. And then the musical director said, where's your song? And I was like, well, I haven't really got a song because I was just, you know, a regular person, and I wasn't from stage school or anything. And he said, do you know any songs? I said, I know What's the Name of the Game by ABBA, because it was in the charts. And he said, I know that. And so we sang it together. And then I went on from there. We got a recall and my mum was like, oh, what do we do now? So it was a complete accident.
Well, everything that's happened since has been certainly not by accident. I mean, you don't end up where you are with the kind of roles that you've had. I mean, I can't believe like Grantchester is 7 seasons in now and it airs in the States as well.
Yeah.
And 7 years, it still feels like a new show to me. Is that weird?
Well, yeah. And I think it's because it's grown. All of the characters within it have grown. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the reason why people like it is because you get the story as a beginning, middle and end, which is very satisfying when you watch something. You get, we all love a campfire story. So a bit of a detective story that rounds up in one episode is nice. But then you also get with this, you get all the other characters outside of that. And our stories filter all the way through. So it's a lovely kind of undercurrent of people that you recognise. So I think that's what's really nice about it.
I know in lockdown, you were home a bit and then at work a bit. And you were amongst the first productions in the industry back doing Grantchester, weren't you? How was it shooting in? Because it's almost hard to remember that first round of lockdown and how little we knew and how frightened everyone was.
Yeah, and we were frightened. There was huge amounts of protocols that we had to go through in order to even get on set. And it was a very strange situation because you're in a mixture between feeling very, very privileged to be able to be doing your job when lots of people in this industry were, you know, they were, their lives had, you know, halted. They got no chance for doing any jobs that they had. You know, anybody in the West End was, you know, it was just awful. And you were hearing horror stories all the time. So I felt very lucky. So it was a mixture between feeling really lucky that I was doing this drama and also the fear of I don't want to get COVID. And also the fear of I don't want to get COVID and bring it into the set from my house because I had, you know, kids at school and all of that. And obviously, that did happen. I did get COVID, but I didn't take it to set because our protocols were watertight. So they knew that I was positive before I had any symptoms. And in fact, I didn't get any symptoms at all. I was a complete super spreader. So I was asymptomatic and pretty much my son was too. He said he felt tired one day, but that's kids. And that was it. But my daughter got it as well. But we were all good. We were all fine with it. Wasn't, you know, anything really, really bad for us. So, you know, I thank my lucky stars on all of that.
I was so fascinated by your backstory and how much you'd done before we even got to know you 20 odd years ago. I mean, can you believe it was 20 odd years ago that EastEnders cast the Slaters? So my first question to you is about those people or those moments that changed everything for you. And I wondered if you could identify one event or a person or a period in your life that was seminal in changing everything for you.
Yeah, I've got a couple in terms of work. So the first one was my first musical director, and he was called John Owen Edwards. And he was a very, very beautiful man. And he was the musical director for Annie. And I wasn't a stage school kid. I was a normal kid from a regular JMI in North London. And he really allowed me to show myself because I think he thought that I'd got something that was right for the show. So when I did Annie in the 70s, they really wanted very natural people. They didn't necessarily want people who had training and were a bit more show busy, you know, a bit more jazz handsy, which is right for some shows. But for this show, they wanted people who kind of could be very natural. And I think he saw that. And I wasn't prepared when I went in for my audition at all, because I'd just done it in the half term break because the Victoria Palace was around the corner from my dad's office. And so we'd literally gone up on spec. So I had no song, no anything. And he was amazing because he just said to me, we riffed it. He said to everyone else before me had got like proper songs. There were girls there in chiffon dresses singing, you know, Mama, he's making eyes at me, all of that. It was literally everything. And I was like, I was completely wide-eyed. I'd never seen anything like this before. And I thought it was amazing and wonderful. But he said to me, you know, and he didn't need to do this. He didn't need to give me this time. But he said to me, what songs do you know? And I said, well, I know What's the Name of the Game by ABBA. And he said, yeah, I know that. He said, come on, let's sing that. And the combination of his natural charm and also his ability to work with children and bring out and make them feel comfortable enough to be able to say, oh, I know this song, and to be able to just riff it, which is what he did, that changed the course of my whole entire life, because then I started working. So he was really the seminal person who said, you know, there's something here. And I'd like to see that and develop that. So he was the first one. And the second one was a guy at drama school who I went in. At drama school, at the end of the year, you have somebody who you have to do a showcase.
Yeah, for agents and things. Is that right?
You can get agent representation and all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So it's a massive moment at the end of your studies. And you were at a very prolific stage school, weren't you? I mean, when I say prolific, it's turned out a lot of the great thespians that we celebrate to this day. Royal Central School of Speech.
There's lots and lots of people who've been through those doors. Lots of people that you know, and, you know, Oscar winners and whatever. And also lots of writers, directors, everybody. Anyway, so I was doing my final showcase and I went up to him. And we had to discuss what we were doing. And I said to him in my, you know, fantastic London speak, which has kind of gone quite a lot. But I said to him, you know, I want to do, I think I'm going to do some Noel Coward because, you know, I look like Patricia Hodge. And she, you know.
Do you do a bit?
I do. I really do. I ended up playing her niece in something. And she said to me, God, yeah, you do look like me. She said, you know, I said to him, I'm going to do Noel Coward. She does loads of Noel Coward and obviously she's really popular and all that. And he listened to me go on about this spiel. And then he just leant in and just went, you're not the second coming of Patricia Hodge. which I thought was great. He said, you're the first you. He said, why don't you do you? You is great. And I was like, Oh, okay. So I went off and I found a speech that I really liked. And it was a really brilliant speech. I loved it. It was all the things that you shouldn't do, an accent, a different male character, all the things that they said, don't do that. But I did it. And then I remember going in the next morning and seeing all these tickets on my photograph. So what they used to do was it was in the old days before, you know, mobile phones or whatever, they'd phone the school and say, leave a message, and then the message would get pinned onto your photograph. I mean, it's quite brutal, because if you were one of the people who didn't have anything pinned onto your photograph, that's hard.
That's all there for all to see. Yeah, that's quite public.
There for everybody to see. And I had all these pins. And I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't think this would happen. You know, my greatest wish when I was leaving was to work at the Royal Court, work with Mike Lee, and then, but the, actually just to work. I didn't care what it was. I just wanted to work. I wanted to get out there and do some work and get my equity card, because you had to have one then, and do all of that. And that's all. And suddenly I looked at this thing and I thought, I've got to go and speak to these people. How do I choose between these people? Because I didn't really know anything. So it was him really saying that gave me the confidence to then just go out and find a piece of my own.
Yeah, and it sounds like these two guys are kind of sort of 15 years apart almost. Would it be 15, 10 years apart? Both tapped your shoulder and said, just be you. You know, I don't want all the jazz hands. I want you as Annie. And then at, you know, at drama school. Just don't do Patricia, do you. And self-belief is something that's so hard to instill in ourselves. I think sometimes we absolutely rely on people to come along at the right point and pour it into our ears so that it sticks in our brains and we remember to believe in ourselves.
Yeah, but I also think that there, it's a really old-fashioned kind of Hollywood idea that someone with a magic wand comes down and says, it's you, you're the one. And actually, all the stuff you do leads to that. Mm. All of the stuff that I suppose I did, which was, you know, even, I mean, obviously the first one was a kind of like more fluky thing, but all of the work that I'd done at drama school, all of the, you know, the soul searching, the pieces, the trying stuff, the failing, all of that, it all leads to that. And I say to people all the time, you know, about auditions and, you know, not getting an audition and not getting a callback. I always say that's not the point. The point, yes, obviously you do want to get the job, but it's what you never know where that goes. You never know where that little bit of you know, film goes, that somebody says, oh, that girl, yeah, she's not right for this, but she's right for that. Nothing is ever wasted. No work that you do, no vocal exercises that you do, no learning to dance, no learning a Czechoslovakian accent for something that you don't get ever goes to waste, because one day it will be there and you will use it and you'll go, thank goodness I did that. Thank goodness I did. Yeah. I invested in myself. So it's never lost. Nothing is ever lost.
It's like human compost, isn't it? It will regenerate into something else and sort of manifest itself in different ways. And you talked there about you had this ambition, this burning ambition to work at the Royal Court, and you did. That was that your first job out of drama school?
It wasn't my first. So I got a job straight out of drama school. I did rep, and I did two plays of Shakespeare and a musical. So that was great. So I had my card, and then it was, I auditioned for Royal Court, and I auditioned for something called Ashes and Sand, which was a brilliant piece, and I didn't get it. I'd gone for a couple of auditions and I was really gutted I didn't get it. Amazing people were in it. Samantha Morton, Susan Lynch. I mean, it was just a brilliant piece about four girls. And I was absolutely gutted. And I remember thinking, oh, this is awful. And my agent at the time, Cassie, she was brilliant. She just said to me, you know, it'll pay dividends. It's fine. Something will happen. And then the very next play they were doing was Joe Pennell's Pale Horse, with Ray.
Ray Winston, a very young Ray Winston then. I mean, we're talking, this is the 80s, yeah?
No, this is the 90s. So this is just before he did Kneel by Mouth.
Ah.
So he'd done some Voices, which was a Joe Pennell play, and that had been very successful. And this is now Joe's second play, and he wanted obviously Ray to be in it because it was so good. And it was amazing for me because I was the only girl in it. And I absolutely loved it. I had an amazing experience, met wonderful people who I still know today. And then what happened was that there was that whole kind of Britpop, Manchester, there was a kind of real working class scene. And I then went on to do lots of plays, which I think then put me in front of Mike Lee. And that's when I started working with him, or did Topsy, did one film with him, did Topsy Turvy. So by the time I got to 98, and I'd left drama school in the early 90s, by the time I got to 1998, I'd done the three things that I'd wanted to do. And I was kind of like, oh, wow. So when EastEnders kind of arrived, I'd always said I didn't want to do it. Because I'd always gone, oh, you know, it's just a bit obvious. You know, you're a London girl. Is this the only trajectory that we have? You know, posh people can play us, but we're not allowed to play them. You know, what's going on? It was that kind of thing.
Which was very much the case at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was no opportunities for people from my background, particularly other than that. And it was like, you know, but then when I went along to the workshop for it, you know, the talent was astounded by the people. You know, there was over 100 of us, and then we got whittled down to 30, and then there was about, in the end, there was about 12 of us, and it kind of like, you know, went backwards and forwards with various different people. Zoe was a boy, first of all, and then Mum was still alive, and then Mum was dead, and it was lots of different things that went on, and it was a good 3-month process of finding us, really. But by the time I got to close to the end of it, I really wanted it by then because I could see how brilliant it was going to be.
Well, you could see the meat on the bones of that family, couldn't you? And there are those characters and those storylines that really capture a nation, and yours did. And you were so understated and perfectly pitched in that role as Little Mo that You broke our hearts, you know, as hers was breaking.
Well, it's a thing, isn't it? You know, a lot of people don't realise how much work goes into obviously doing a soap. And some people are very similar to their characters and some people are very different. It just depends. It's all about your process. And they always used to take the mickey out of me because I had a character book. I had loads of different things that I would do that I would think about with her. I used to use Laban technique for certain scenes. And I would do,
what's the Laban technique?
So what that is it's you have these different sets of emotions, and they can be they can be light and dark. They can be consistent and they can be heavy, or they can be consistent or fast, or they can be heavy or light. So if you think about somebody who's quite ethereal, they're probably quite light, aren't they?
Yeah.
And obviously with Little Mo, I did that. One of the emotions that I used to use is ringing. And so, and she would often be, so if you think about ringing, it's constant, it's heavy, and it's dark. Because if you're ringing your hands, it's just,
yeah. It's intense.
You have that heavy feeling with it, don't you?
There's an angst to it as well, isn't
yeah.
there? And she was angst-ridden whilst trying to pretend that she was fine.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And that's, yeah. So that internal feeling, so I work internally. So that was how internal feeling did it for me. But I also used to have little external things that I kind of did over time. She would always hold her sleeves. Because, you know, when you're young and you kind of pull your sleeves down because you don't really, you feel awkward and don't know what to do. I would hold my sleeves. Her clothes would be slightly too big for her. And Perry used to do this as well. Perry Fennett used to do this as well. He always used to have his suit, his shirt yeah. slightly too big for him. So it was like he was inside the suit. the suit was wearing him. He wasn't wearing the suit. So where, you know, somebody yeah. like Marta Kemp had a beautiful fitting suit that was like all yeah. suave and white. Perry was inside his suit, which gave him an air.
Yeah, he was a bit more Rodney than Del Boy, wasn't he?
Yeah. It gave him a kind of little boy quality, really. That he wasn't quite comfortable. And so there's little things like that that people would never pick up on, but that you do as an actor to make you feel, like, you know, like your character. And again with her, the pitch of my voice, all of those things. And they came over time. And I loved that. I loved that. I've got books and books and books on her.
Have you?
I loved that. Yeah, I've got a lot. And I loved the, I didn't look at them for years, but I just loved constantly thinking about that. And that's really what I like to do. I like to create characters, really kind of inhabit them. And then put them to bed and move on to the next one.
I mean, the joy with the soap is you get so much time to invest in a character because you're with her every day. It's 52 weeks a year, pretty much, give or take a holiday here and there. And you don't get that even if you're doing a film. You know, eventually you come to the end of the runway with a film shooting schedule. But a soap is just, it just carries on. And I think to the, you know, when she finally found her voice and stood up for herself, all of that investment you'd made in her made her far more powerful, because when she did, the nation was lit. I remember it so well. It was like, yes, go on, you were so behind her.
Yeah, no, it was brilliant. It was brilliant to play, and it was so well written and crafted, and all of those great things that you have with something like that that's been allowed to develop over a period of time. But it is something that they've done with Kathy, really, in Grantchester as well. They've allowed me to invest. And they've allowed me to talk about her as a character, and because sometimes the wives of the detectives in a series tend to be thankless tasks. You know, generally they're seen in the kitchen going, you know, oh, why aren't you home?
Oh, well done. I knew you'd do it.
You're so great. Yeah.
Supporting cast, right? And you're not supporting cast.
Well, you know, so what we did was, you know, we talked a lot about women in the 50s and how they, how, I mean, if I said to you, if you have an image in your head of a woman in the 50s, you'd probably think big skirt, baking.
Yeah.
And we've been sold this idea. And I think this happens in lots of different ways. We've been sold an idea of what women were like and what they did.
Yeah, but they weren't actually. They were post-war women who'd worked, raised families on their own. I mean, they were superheroes in so many ways.
We had a conversation about the fact that that all of our grandmothers, there's a two female executives on Grantchester and Tessa and myself, and we all go out for dinner. We all have a dinner. We have a girls' dinner. And we sat there and we talked about the fact that all of our grandmothers, and we all come from different backgrounds and we're all different ages, all of our grandmothers worked. All of our grandmothers had a job. And we said, why is it that we only ever see in period pieces, you know, a lot of women are domestic? And that's the only way you see them. And it was really important to us that we looked at actually what the misrepresentation, and when, no, we're going to give Kathy a job. Mrs. C has a job. You know, she runs the household, but yet she's very traditional. That became a very important thing. And so that's what we've done. We've done that with Kathy, and she has developed over the time, which is just brilliant. And again, like this is what I say, is what I love to find. And yeah. I'm very lucky because Robson isn't the kind of actor who insists on having a wife who's 20 years younger than him. You know, he's quite happy with me. So it's really nice because he...
You say that like you're some sort of booby prize. You're fabulous. What he wants at his side is an actor that can act him off the stage should they need to. And you can.
Well, we both really compliment each other. I absolutely adore him. I think he's...
He's a good guy, isn't he?
Do you know what? He's one of the most underrated actors in this country. Everything I've ever seen him in, I've always believed. And to make it look that easy, it's a real skill. To make you like him that quickly, it's a real, real skill. And he's, literally everything I've seen him in, I've loved him in. And he's a great guy. And he's championed Michael's as Kathy in this too. It's all, you know, it wouldn't have happened without his input and him saying, yes, it's really important, their dynamic and the fact that, his home life, how important it is to him. You know, it's great. And it's lovely to be collaborative because in America, this happens quite a lot. You get a lot of actors who are allowed to be collaborative. But in this country, it doesn't happen so much. And I think that's probably because there's a worry that actors will go, well, I want to be wearing a tiara and some, you know, lovely frocks all the time or something, you know, superficial like that. But a lot of the time, it's just literally character work. You want it to have depth and flavour, and so that people like that and it'd be surprising. So that, and that's what you want because people are surprising. Nobody is stereotypical. So don't write a stereotypical part.
But I think we're seeing a real revolt in that respect and with actors letting their work do the talking for them. And you've got brilliant women like Reese Witherspoon and Nicole Kidman bringing female-led stories to the screen on their terms, both having been told by Hollywood that they might be past their sell-by date, you know?
I know.
Which is actually outrageous. And then they let their work do the talking for them because actually they're more than capable of being more than just actors. They can produce, they can exec, they can direct.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, it's the same, you know, if you remember all those years ago when we were kind of starting out and you were starting out, you know, they said, oh, Spice Girls, you know, nobody wants female pop bands. Yeah. It's only boy bands. They won't buy the records. Nobody will buy their records.
Well, this was a dilemma I faced because I was the editor of Smash Hits at the time. And the girls pounded into my office one afternoon to introduce themselves and were undeniable. And they wanted to be on the cover. And I said, look, I'll do a piece covering you and introducing you and we will endorse you because we all think you're great, not just me, the whole team. But I can't give you a cover until you get a number one because girls don't sell magazines. But if you've got a number one, then I can take that upstairs and I can fight your case. And also, nothing else was working at the time. You know, take that split up. Britpop was everywhere. Pop had been sort of reduced. The colour had been sucked out of it slightly. So I had to fight to get them on the cover. And they needed to sort of have a measurable kind of result, which was a number one, in order for the publishers to get behind that decision as well, which is quite outrageous. But I'm glad that, you know, we helped to buck a trend.
Yeah. And don't you often find that people say things like, you know, the stuff that's been misrepresented, girls don't get on, girls are bitchy.
Absolute shite. Yeah.
It's just total rubbish, isn't it? Because, I've been in two jobs where it was all female casts. I can't tell you the amount of people went, oh, how was that? And I went, it was absolutely fabulous. And I have to tell you, we went out again. We enjoyed ourselves so much on the first run that we all went out again, and none of us needed to go out again. But we said, yeah, we'll all go out again. We want the same, you know, the same cast, because we really enjoyed ourselves. And so I think quite a lot of the time, there's so much that we've grown up with, that's in our bones, that people tell us about how women are, you know, women are bitchy in the workplace. What the hell is all that about?
That's not been my experience. Has it yours?
Never been my experience. Never been my experience. And you think, where does this come from? Where do these kind of outdated tropes come from that we listen to? And we go, well, that's, and it's because, you know, you pitch people against one another. You pitch young against old. You pitch, you know, females against other females. And then you can kind of say you've got an out clause or something. I don't know. I don't know why we've had to put up with this, but I'm loving the fact that now we've got internet and Twitter and Instagram and all of those things. We can have our own voices and say, I don't recognize this. This isn't part of my life. This hasn't been part of my working life. And if it has been part of my working life, it's normally from somebody who's had to fight tooth and nail to get to be recognized themselves. So it's come from a place of, literally having to fight to get one decent line. Although, you know, I mean, you know, I look at some of the other actresses that I've worked with, and they're just amazing.
But it's interesting, because even like going right back to Kathy's predicament of, like, you know, you saying, well, you spoke with the producers and Robson, it's like, let's give Kathy a job because you want to defy the stereotypes of a woman of that time. And I'm really interested to see how you're going to play her now that she is a woman of a certain time who's been cheated on. Because how we would deal with that as women now versus, I mean, like, divorce was so uncommon back then. Like, what do you do, and the hurt that you carry, and how do you find forgiveness? And now you'd be screaming and shouting and you'd have a voice, but would she have had a voice back then?
No, and I think that was part and parcel of her going out and getting a job as well, and wanting to get a job, wanting to be a bit more independent, not wanting to, and I think that's great, but also, there were, you know, women's lib didn't just happen in the 60s. You know, women had worked during the war. They'd worked in factories. They'd worked on the land. They'd done all of those things. They'd had to keep everything going here. And I don't think they were prepared to go back to being chained to the kitchen sink. I just don't think they were.
Nah.
And so that's something that I think also gave the kind of impetus towards the women's liberation movement, which kind of started very early on in the 60s. But, you know, and we had to fight so much against lots of other things because, you know, media was run by a very small group of people. And so it was whatever they liked or whatever their bent was. I mean, I don't know about you, but growing up, I found that the women that were on television, they were either battle axes or dolly birds. I didn't have anything in between. So when I watched people, like when I watched things in the 80s, like Widows and Band of Gold and...
Oh, Widows was so good.
And Tenko.
And Band of Gold, Kathy Tyson, Tenko, yes.
I was like, these women, they're all very different. They're all very different. There isn't, you know, it isn't just dolly birds and battle axes. It's not stereotypical. It's amazing that I was seeing these wonderful actresses do show that had huge audiences. And they weren't necessarily about posh people either. I get bored with that as a diet of what I'm watching on television. We had to grow up with huge stereotypes.
And now our job is to kind of help to shatter them, really, and to,
well, it is,
to actually put them into a more realistic perspective.
Yeah.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring.
At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Perspective's an interesting one, actually, because that kind of takes me to my next question with you, because I know that you have spent many years learning more about autism and all of the foibles that sit around it, not just the practicalities of how you manage a child like Elwood who has Asperger's and dyspraxia. Is that right?
Yeah. Asperger's, yeah.
Also trying to emotionally be able to understand where he's at. And you've spoken at times so eloquently around this. And I thought it was really interesting. What do you think that you've learned that has enhanced you or inspired you or made you think differently, having had to kind of almost get down on your knees and look at life through his lens?
Well, I think it's just that. The things that I've learned are that everybody looks at things differently, and his take on the world is like that. And actually, it's, you only need to make reasonable adjustments in order to accommodate people who have differing abilities. And A, we don't see enough of that. And B, we need to be more accommodating, because I think there's a lot of situations where children are excluded from school, say, or a lot of young people in prison. A lot of them are undiagnosed with various, like I say, differing abilities. And if we just look at those children and say, right, this child is not going to sit on a mat and listen to a story, because this child can't do that. So what else can I do for this child? And that's why things like fidget spinners came in, because then your child will sit on a mat and listen to the story because they've got a fidget spinner to also deal with. And that is, but what used to happen was that teachers would go, you can't do that because everyone will want one. Well, not everyone has a differing ability.
Or that child would be sent to sit somewhere else like a punishment because they couldn't conform. But that's beyond their ability to be able to conform. Or understanding, for example, as a teacher, that a child with autism that rocks back on their chair, that's self-soothing. That is them calming themselves. That's not them disrupting. That's the antithesis of them being disruptive in their mind. And if you can see that and understand it, explain it to the rest of the class. That's, then problem goes away, doesn't it?
All the children don't even have an issue. I always say to people, this is a really nice story. My daughter had in her class a boy who was diagnosed with moderate to severe autism. And she'd known him from the age of 4. And he was also had a sight issue, so he was practically blind, and his sight was never going to be brilliant, but he could see enough to wander around, to be around school. He had an assistant, right? He was a lovely kid. Anyway, when Elwood was going through all of his diagnosis, obviously you have to go through hundreds and hundreds of meetings, which always makes me laugh, because I think the worst thing you can do to a child with autism is make them meet loads of different people in strange atmospheres. It was just...
You could not exasperate them more, could you?
Exactly. So anyway, we were doing all of those. And my daughter said to me... you know, why is Elwood going up for all of this, all of these, you know, tests? Because I didn't do this. Why is he doing it? And I thought, oh my goodness, she's 9. She's had this boy in her class since they were 4 together. You know, she'll understand because he has autism and obviously his sight issue, but she'll understand this process. And so I said, they think that Elwood has the same thing as your friend. Obviously, I'm not going to name him, as your friend.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh my God, Elwood's going blind. She didn't see the boy's autism at all. All she saw was his physical difficulty with seeing. She saw nothing of that. And she's always said to me, my whole year would have been not as it was if we hadn't have had him in our class, because we all knew that he looked at the world in a different way. And she said in some ways it was really exciting, because you just didn't know what he was going to do. And she said, and it was great and brilliant. And they all knew how to soothe it. She never even questioned that he had autism. She was more concerned with the fact that he had a sight issue. And so she only needed to be told certain things, certain words were triggers for him. So nobody said those words. And there was a time where he said to her, he said, oh, I'm feeling really stressed or whatever. And she said, oh, plait my hair. And he sat in, so whenever he used to get a little bit stressed, he'd go, oh, give us your plait. And he'd replait her hair. So just an action of doing something like that, you know, taking her hair out and doing that, got him over a little hump of feeling really anxious. And this was just a thing that they had discovered between themselves. How wonderful is that? So, you know, I've learned so much about how you can help people, and also the fact that with autism you have to score on three different levels, but there are lots of children out there who have the traits, and there's a lot of children out there who might have difficulty with one of those traits as well, or two of those traits. So they don't score overall, but they have two traits of autism, which means that if you put things in place for your child with autism, there's other children who will benefit from that too.
Yeah. Yeah, but actually, you're quite right. There's a ripple effect there.
There's a crossover between some children. If you've got a child in your class who doesn't like change as well, who isn't on the autism spectrum, but finds it really difficult to deal with changes in routines, then what you implement for this child, you implement for that child as well. And it works. Yeah. There's actually lots of traits that are very similar. You know, people who don't like, who like things in order. There's lots of people like that, but it doesn't mean they're autistic, but they have a trait.
But do you think you would have had, I mean, actually, I think you would have had that kind of ability to look at things differently, because look at how you've tried to reposition Kathy, for example, by telling the story authentically of women of that time, as opposed to what we've been served as a view of a woman of that time.
Yeah, well, there's that. And there's, I remember when I did Call the Midwife, I had to play someone who had a lobotomy.
How'd you do that?
There's nothing on the internet, because obviously you didn't, you know, photograph people or film people who'd had lobotomies. And so there was nothing on there. And so I thought to myself, I read a lot about it, and it's about a disconnect. So obviously there's a part of your brain that they disconnect. So there's a disconnect. And I was out walking my dogs, and there was a lot of fog. And I suddenly felt like I wasn't connected to the world, because I was stuck in this little kind of foggy cave, if you know what I mean. I couldn't see. And I thought, oh, that feels really, that feels like I've got a disconnect. And then I thought, as I came back from that, I thought to myself, right, okay, it's not quite fog, because you can move fog. And for me, the feeling of the character was that she was under ice, because you can see, you can see out, you can see people, you can see their faces, but you can't get to them because it's solid. So that was my first point. And I had a brilliant director called Thaddeus O'Sullivan who gave me a painting. So that was my second point. And then I sometimes use music. So there's a Kate Bush, I always use her all the time, because she
can never go wrong with Kate Bush, can you?
She invokes loads of things within her music. And so I put all those three together, and then I could play her with just a slight disconnect to what was going on in the world. And that's how but again, it's a creative process. You have to think about it. You have to look it up. You have to try things.
It's all sensory, right? A lot of what you're doing is sensory, which again enables you to really connect with your son and your husband, who has a similar diagnosis. Am I right?
Yeah, he's not my husband, but
the same as your father. Sorry, yeah.
So he has a similar similar thing. And his dad too. So, I mean, there's a whole debate going on in the autism community at the moment about there's some research going into people with autism, and there's some who are really for it and some that are really against it. So, I'm listening to the debate about
it.
Because, you know, if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. Yeah, that's it. It's kind of like saying, you know, all deaf people are the same. You know, it's just, you know, it's just madness.
And they will see and feel life differently.
Yeah, they will. They will. And sometimes that's a really amazing lens to look through.
I think so.
Yeah.
You look at some of the greatest disruptors, not just of the here and now, but of history. A lot of them would have presented as being certainly on the spectrum. Some of them have been diagnosed as being on the spectrum. But you need that point of difference. Otherwise, how do we create change and innovate and revolutionize?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And there's a book called Neurotribes, which is written by a guy called Steve Silberman. And he thinks that the autism mind is the next evolutionary mindset. So he thinks because sometimes autism minds can think on lots of different levels, and certainly children with ADHD, they can often look at like three different screens and have an ability to go through three different screens. So they can work on something here, work on something here, work on something here. And that's kind of evolution, because why would you wouldn't have needed to do that in the 1940s, but now you're playing into people's, so it's an interesting debate as to whether it's the next mindset, and that's why we're seeing more people and hearing about more people, or it's just the fact that we understand, we don't know about how the brain works. So we don't really know everything that say like we need to know about heart, you know. If there's something that goes wrong in your heart, there's ways to fix it. But with the brain, it's a very different situation. So it's the last medical mountain, I suppose, understanding the brain and how it works, and you know how all of our neurons kind of bounce across each other.
I think one of the most intelligent things I've heard in a while is, and we forget to do this, is you saying, "I'm listening to the debate," because everybody expects us to have either answers or an opinion, and you can have different answers at different times, because what you hear during a debate can change and inform and shape those, and we have to allow that process. And it's so often that we are expected to have a fixed position, and actually listening to a debate is the greatest way to continue to learn and expand our own minds.
Especially if you're listening, if the people who are having the debate are the people who have the condition, who am I to say what should be right or wrong? It's down to that community as well to talk about how they wish to be either investigated or not pinned down or not stuck in a this is what this is and this is what that is, you know. So there's a big debate going on. It's interesting.
My final question, what's the one long shot that you've taken that really has paid off?
I guess it is the fact that I got rid of my prejudice about being in a soap and took it on. So instead of getting cross that everybody wanted to pigeonhole me, I took this fantastic genre and enjoyed every moment of it. And it was a long shot because there's been many families who've gone into the show and are out within a year because it doesn't quite work. And I guess as well, we were the first family of girls in that show, so it was,
you were the Spice Girls of Albert Square.
Well, kind of. And it was,
yeah, you were.
It was a long shot to do that because that wasn't the direction I was going in. You know, like I say, I'd just done a Mike Lee movie. I just finished at the National. And it's always very funny because none of those places will employ me now because I've been in the soap. So
is that right? Do you find that there's a prejudice that kind of yeah. travels behind you.
Yeah, there is. Yeah,
with that.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. Especially if you're in a southern soap. Especially if you're a Londoner in a London soap. I don't know why. I mean, it doesn't happen to absolutely everybody, but it is a fight to get out of that. But yeah.
I think a lot of actors who've walked that path into a soap would say that they share that experience.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a snobbery around it.
There is.
But if you were in a 9 o'clock drama like Grantchester that attracts millions of viewers, the same sort of numbers as the soap, you would be hailed as a critical success.
Well, yeah, but it's because, you know, it's because I'm a working class girl. So generally you're not allowed to get out of your box, are you? But I think that's getting less and less. And I love the fact that I work with so many young people and they all say the same thing. You know, I worked with a really brilliant girl called Sheila Koch, and she's a BAFTA rising star. And she said, I didn't see any parts that were on television for me. So I wrote them myself. Mm-hmm. And I thought, yes. Girl,
yeah.
That's what you do. I love that. I love that whole, you know, you just write, you write it yourself. My daughter just had a play that was longlisted at the National, and she's only 16. She's written a really gorgeous play. And I love that we are getting, people are going now, well, I'm not going to wait until, you know, we've talked earlier on about, I'm not going to wait till that big finger of fate comes down. I'm going to make that happen for myself. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to write it. People like Emerald Fennell, you know, people from lots of different stratas of society are making their own stuff.
Be the change you want to see.
Yeah. But yeah, I think getting rid of my prejudice against soap, I think, was the best thing that happened, because I had an amazing time. And quite often the things that you go, oh, I don't want to do that, actually turn out to be the best.
Yeah. And you did work that was it work that you are truly proud of?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah, and that's why I don't mind the reference to her. I don't mind it at all, because it was everything I wanted it to be. I was allowed to develop a character over a period of time, and I did it day in, day out for 6 years. And that was a privilege, mm-hmm. you know. And also people, you know, I literally had someone last week who said to me that her friend, somebody who was on Grantchester with me, that a friend of hers had actually got out of the relationship that she was with, which was abusive, because she'd watched that storyline and thought, I have to get out of this. And that's amazing. You know, 20 years later, you're hearing from someone who you're working with, whose friend did that. That's incredible. And that's a wonderful thing for the whole show. That's not to do with me as a person, but, you know, I was the conduit that it went through. Yeah. And so I needed to play her correctly. And I also, the thing about her was that I never wanted her to change. I didn't want her suddenly to become like, you know, Bette Lynch or Pat Butcher or something like that.
I killed Trevor, stand back, bitch.
Yeah, you know,
she had to stay her.
She had to stay
her. And actually, that was the success of her not being defined by the abuse, right? Was to stay her.
Stay her. And so many people used to write to me and say, you know, I'm really unconfident and I really relate to her, and that she's really, you know, unconfident. And it's so lovely to see someone who's allowed to be like that.
Yeah.
And carry on, you know. The worst thing they could have done was do her a makeover. I mean, every time we did a joke makeover, it was always, you know, Kat throwing on some leopard print onto her, and it never really worked.
But there was great comedy in those moments.
There was
also a lot of reality, because in a family that was as diverse in terms of people's temperaments, that surely would have gone, you know, especially, you know, a clan of sisters, that surely would have happened.
Yeah, I mean, we had such a laugh filming a lot of it, and some difficult times as well, but such a laugh filming so much of it. And I haven't seen hardly any of it. So I'm kind of waiting until it comes around. I think there's one that shows Vintage EastEnders. There's a channel that's showing it, and it's coming up to the time where we're coming in, because I just didn't watch it at the time because I was too busy playing it. And if I watched it, then I would be critiquing myself. So I just never watched it. I watched some of the bits. Obviously, when you go on television, they show you bits of what you've done. But there was also things that I couldn't watch because it was so painful to do. And I just didn't really want to, just didn't really want to go there, you know. And certainly my kids couldn't watch it because it was, you know, it was quite hard.
Harrowing for them.
Yeah, harrowing, because I was their mom. You know, Harry, if I wasn't their mum, but Harry, if I was their mum.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it was a, that was my, never be Never be snobbish about anything. Get rid of your working class chip on your shoulder.
And get over yourself and get on with it. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. I love that you can own it with great pride now. That's great.
It's what it is.
And I know that you're back in production on season 7 now, as they call it in the States, because this is a show that is a co-production between here and America.
Yeah, it is.
I know you're back in your pointy bras and your wigs.
I am.
On Grantchester.
I am. That's why I don't need to dye my hair, because I've got a wig on. From roots. Because I've got a wig on for the next, you know, few months. I mean, I've been filming. We did them back to back. So we did 6 and then had a little break and then went straight into 7.
Wow.
So I've been filming solid for a year now. Well, it will be a year when I've finished, just over a year. So yes, lovely and gorgeous and wonderful. And looking forward to it coming out on the 3rd of September, I think it is. It comes out here and then 3rd of October in America.
Thank you so much for sharing so much of your past and your wisdom. It's been so lovely to hear about all of the investment that you've made into two brilliant characters that are so different. And I can see now why they stand out, because you've poured so much time and love and care and attention into them.
What I like to do, innit?
Innit? And you can find Grantchester in it on ITV back September 3rd and also on Catch Up, because let's face it, most of us live in a world of catch up now, don't we?
We do. We love a bit of catch up. I think the first one's not until the 3rd of September here. And then we've got 8. So it's either every Friday. You can either do it and then watch Gogglebox on Catch Up after. So you do Grantchester and then do Gogglebox at 10. So you're going to be fine. So yeah, there's all
sorts of choices. And then it's bedtime. That's it. Your weekend starts here.
Exactly.
Casey, thank you so much. Continued success. Good luck with the pointy brows, the wigs. And I don't need to say with the series, because it's already a slam dunk.
Yeah, it's all good. Thank you. It's so lovely to talk to you and see you.
Well, that's it from us for this week. As always, the show is produced by me, Kate Thornton, with Libby Knowles and Richard Hatherall for Yahoo UK, and our music comes courtesy of Andy Bell. Don't forget, we've got live shows rolling into the West End of London this month with Craig Revel Hallward. Next month, October, with the cast of Grange Hill, who are reuniting live on stage. And in November, the cast of Dunbreeden, Tamsin Outhwaite, Julie Graham, Denise Welsh, Tracy Ann Oberman, and Alison Newman. Tickets are available wherever you get your tickets. That's it. We're back next week with more great chat. Until then, take care out there.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.